It is Saturday, July 2nd, 2011. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxel. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on GeekSpeak, we're covering geek news. And in the house with me, I'm Lyle Troxel. And in the house with me, I've got Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy and sometimes Stanford instructor.
Yo, what up?
What up, man? We really just do that? I'm gonna edit the podcast.
I don't know. I'm sorry. Hello. Nasty. Hello, everyone.
Thank you. Hello, Ben. And also Jordan Hart. Jordan Hart is a technical director of digital media at the Digital Media Academy. Also a Stanford instructor, I guess, thereby.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning. Not so much, huh? You think Ben's comment about that is kind of ridiculous because it's not really Stanford?
It's on Stanford's campus, right?
Well, accredited through Stanford.
All right, let's move along. I think we're going to start with Mr. Miles Elam, now 37 years old and happy as a clam.
Are clams happy? I never really understood that. Anyway.
I think so. I think they rest all the time. They're sleep. So
I'm a clam. I'm happy.
People that are 37 and older appreciate sleep, and so happy as sleep. I think that's how that
So I'm going to talk a little bit about Google Plus, just to start that conversation, because it's on the lips of many technology people talking about, is it a Facebook
killer?
Is Facebook going to go the way of MySpace? Is it now an heir apparent?
Or Friendster?
Right. Because each time there was something new and people left the other one en masse.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, Google Plus, the user base is there, right? Because if you've got a Gmail account, and a lot of people do.
Exactly.
It moves over really easily. And I mean, there's definitely moving social networks is a definitely complicated process, but they do have some features that I think.
Yeah, there are some issues with, I mean, Google, as a large company that aggregates a huge amount of data, there are privacy issues there. But in general, I think Google has had a better record with regard to protection of privacy, respect of privacy, than Facebook has.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the problems, of course, with security, with privacy issues really has to do with we don't think very well about privacy. We don't have a good language about it. But we won't get into that topic. I want to invite listeners of GeekSpeak to go ahead and send a note to us if you want a Gmail Plus access, because there's four of us in the air room. And if you go to our website, geekspeak.org, and click on the email geeks and say, I want an account, just give us your Gmail account and we'll all invite you and maybe you'll get service. Because it's not totally open to everybody.
Right.
Point.
It is not. Which some people have been joking about, saying it's a social network, but you can't join unless you're invited.
You know, this is true with all social networks, though. I mean, when they first start, the way to start them for some reason is to make it a limited thing.
Gmail was that true of MySpace? I thought MySpace just opened it.
I don't know Friendster if MySpace as well. But Facebook was definitely like that. It was closed at first.
It depends on if you already have a huge user base. I mean, like Google has tons and tons and tons of people using all of its services. So anytime it introduces anything new, it has to roll it out to a limited set so it can make sure everything works properly.
I don't think it's just that. I think it's an experience. Like they want to, the users they're inviting are technically savvy. We're all going to be able to use it and figure it out. Mm-hmm. And as we use it and figure it out, we'll have expertise in it. And then once we're using it, when other people join, even if it's frustrating for them, which is kind of frustrating as you don't learn it, as you don't know it very well, the momentum will be there to help those people through it.
But there is something very specifically different between Facebook and the Google Plus model. Google Circle, among the other utilities, which is you can get the data out of Google services. You can actually export all of that data as a big chunk.
Google has a pretty good support for that kind of thing.
As opposed to Facebook. Facebook, they control the data. Your data is there. Say, for example, you used Facebook as your personal blog. Many people actually do this. Either as a modified form of Twitter and also put in notes, use it as their own personal journal. If Facebook decides to kill your account, all that data is gone. And there's no easy way of pulling that data out, like as one big chunk. You can do it on an ad hoc basis, but there's no actual API to pull everything out ready to go.
And this means as you create content in Facebook, you're really kind of giving it away to some other company. I mean, they could potentially start charging or do something where your data wasn't accessible. Heck, they could decide, you know what, we don't need data from 2 years ago and just start deleting it. There's no protection, if you will.
Right. I think there's a social aspect to Facebook that would prevent them from doing it. That, I mean, as a business standpoint, if they started doing that,
it'd be bad for them.
Yeah. I think they have a rational self-interest to prevent themselves from doing that.
I spent the last couple days trying to figure out ways of downloading and copying my blog data from different services that I've used over the years, so I know it's in one place and it's stored and saved. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've got multiple accounts that I've got that in, and I haven't cleared all of them. Some of them, like Tumblr, it's extremely easy to do that with. Facebook, it's not. In fact, it's so hard to find all your data on Facebook, because if you commented on a message by somebody else that was a friend of yours that commented, and then you commented on them, but you're not a friend with them, you actually can't see that post anymore. It's very hard to find. Finding stuff in general on Facebook is very difficult. Yep. So this is going to be completely different, because Google has the standpoint that data is accessible. If it's your data, you can get to it. Do they have some?
Well, they have that. Statement? That's true of all of their services. And this is something that I've actually always been impressed with Google about, which is, for example, their search engine. There's nothing locking you into using their search engine. A lot of people use their search engine just because it's so good.
Right.
But any given day, if some search engine came out, or if Microsoft Bing became noticeably better, or you know, something like that, or a new competitor came out, people would leave that Google search engine and use another one, and there's no barrier to transition.
Right.
And here's what's so interesting about that. When you open up Chrome to begin with, when you first start using Chrome, Google Chrome, it asks you what search engine you want to use, and it has three logos, Google, Yahoo, and Bing. And you can click on one of those and say, that's the search engine I prefer. I mean, I clicked Google, but I didn't have to. I could have clicked Bing, and I would be using Google's product without Google's search. Right. And that's attractive. Yeah.
And most modern browsers actually have that ability. Mm-hmm. In the search box, you can have a drop down and choose, like, I want to do, and actually put in custom ones as well.
And that's really, I mean, that ability, and for the reason why Google does that is because of the Microsoft antitrust lawsuit. That Microsoft, in that case, it was pretty clear that you need to separate your concerns of that nature. You don't want to lock people into a certain thing. Now, but the Google search thing, you would never be trapped, because there's not that much data that's actually being stored about you. It's not like you've got your bookmarks in Google search. Like
right,
Gmail,
but if you look
for example,
at Gmail,
you can export all your Gmail pretty easily, right?
Right. In fact, you can, for a client, it's an IMAP client. You can use whatever mail client you want with it, and then you and I have both transferred email from one IMAP client to another. It's really crazy. Is you drag and drop,
right.
As long as you're using the IMAP protocol.
IMAP I had a lot of trouble with it. It was very hard to do.
Really,
I
mean, you had more than just...
Well, it was so much emails problem.
It
had
it was a bandwidth issue. But
and it was basically, once I did it, my client had some trouble. It started looping, and then Gmail shut that IP down for a few days. You know, there was some issues around it. But there's actually services that allow you to do this where they tether it down a bit. And you can actually download apps that will allow you to do this as well. But in any case, the idea is that Google's not trying to trap the data in. I don't know if Facebook is trying to trap the data, or if it's just extremely complicated to export that kind of data.
Aside from the fact that not every page had some obnoxious song playing like MySpace did, Facebook also had an advantage in that it made APIs available to third-party developers.
Right away.
So that's really what pushed things into the push people towards.
What you're talking about is these applications, these Facebook applications that you are for photo. Anything you basically are doing on Facebook that's above and beyond just sending text messages is actually an application that other people can write.
Right.
And Facebook has a few that's kind of built in. Google's doing the same thing.
And in fact, third party developers use the same APIs that the Facebook developers were using. That was one of the big deals having to do there. And it was a tremendous improvement over the model that MySpace had. Which was even more of a walled garden, although a much louder and garish one. But Google, on the other hand, they have the APIs and access to the data together. It's not just access to snippets of data like it is with the Facebook API.
Right. Okay, so Google Plus, real quick, when you use it, when you log into it, it shows up after you log into your Gmail account and your Google account, if you will, over on the left, it has a name with a plus in the front of it. Click on that, and you get a page that looks a little bit like Facebook, and looks a little bit like Twitter, and looks a little bit like Gmail. I guess that's the best way to describe it. Mm-hmm. And the big feature that's clear right off the bat is that you now are, when you share content on Google Plus, like a Facebook post, but you do it on Google Plus, you actually decide what circles of your community get to see it. So you can post the drunk, you know, party shots uncomfortably. Photos you don't want to share with your boss or your parents, you can post that to your local friends, and only your local friends can see it. And it's relatively simple to do that, and it's simple to search through the groups. Kind of like Facebook has groups like this, right, where you can kind of filter what you see, but you can't filter when you post who gets to see what you
yes,
post.
You can.
You can.
You can choose which. Yeah, you can choose. Although I do have to say, from my own personal opinion, that the Google Circles interface is much more intuitive and easy to use.
Yeah,
the
Google
one, or the Facebook one, has historically always been that much more difficult, where geeks are going, wow, this is kind of difficult to try to navigate and figure out how my security settings. And if you're a general user, there's, in general, we've told people, like, there's no hope. Like, you need someone to help you with this.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Facebook has been a little schizophrenic with how they want to have their security policy done. In the beginning, only a friend or a friend of a friend could see your data. And then over time, they made it so that more people could see it, acquaintances or everyone, like everyone became the default posting. But they didn't necessarily tell people very clearly. And so there's been a back and forth on that and setting up people with individual groups after the data's been going in, because it was hacked on after the fact, made it a bit more clunky.
Yeah, and Facebook has been very bad about notifying users when the privacy policy changes, or little things, maybe big privacy. They do notify when the privacy policy changes or things like that, but they don't really notify when little features actually change the way you should use the app. You know?
The thing is, being notified by Facebook the policy's changed is, it doesn't help you at all. It's not the way to do it in some sense, right? It really should be when you log into Facebook, when you use it, it should stop you and make you read this kind of change. But the thing is that the legalese document doesn't work, and the application settings definitions don't work except for programmers. It's extremely complicated and hard to describe this problem of privacy in these networks. And I really think it has to do with not having a good understanding of what it means. I mean, for example, let's just talk really briefly in the room. We all have family members, right? And we might feel differently about what we're sharing individually, what we'd want to share with our family, right? I might share something that would be inappropriate from Miles' perspective to share with his father, right? I might share with my mother. And that idea that it might be inappropriate, it's a personal choice. And it's hard to codify that, if you will. And I mean code, meaning write code to describe that problem, where we don't think about it consciously almost.
Right. I do have to step in and play devil's advocate a little bit. I do have to defend Facebook some, because they have been a pioneer in a lot of these areas.
No, absolutely.
And so many of the questions about privacy with these social networks didn't exist
when
Facebook was first coding it. So I want to backpedal a little bit and say, like, Facebook is not, you know, totally evil because they've done these things. And Google Circles, I think, is better because they've had that hindsight to be able to see what the problems were.
I completely agree with you, Miles. That's kind of what I'm trying to say, is that it's a complicated problem that we haven't really addressed as people before, right? We're trying to solve these problems we've never really had problems with.
I think we have addressed it as people, but we've never tried to, but you're right, we never had to codify it.
Yeah.
Because we do constantly say, oh, I want to call up these group of people for a party,
right,
and I don't invite my mother to the drunken bash.
And there's always been this sticky situation, too, of the friend of the friend. You know, a friend comes to something and you're not sure if you want to hang out with them again, but you do.
Right.
And all those problems are social problems that emerge in, and over time we kind of let it, you know, it resolves itself. Like, Jordan today could be really offensive to me, right? And I'd never want to talk to him again. But if Ben went to a party in a year from now and brought Jordan, I wouldn't have a big deal with it. Who cares, right? Because time has passed. But online, it kind of becomes this more permanent thing almost.
But also you have that social convention of, you invite a friend to a party, your friend then asks you, becomes the surrogate to say, can my friend so-and-so come, the friend of a friend? And that has shrunken somewhat. That has flattened
kind of gone away.
So all these social dynamics that we don't think about because they're natural to us. They're something that we've grown up with.
The one thing I love about, what I'm thinking is going to happen is people that use Facebook are also going to create Plus accounts, and Google Plus is going to be popular as well, and people are going to jump between them, and you'll actually have a real social network that's large enough in both spaces to have competition, and competition breeds great new development. So from that perspective, I'm really excited about it. I think that also you're going to see plugins that allow you post in Facebook or Google Plus and it shows up in the other one, and those things are going to start to merge a bit. I'm sure that will happen to some degree. But Ben, you want to have a point on this?
Yeah. I think one of the things that Google did right, and again, we were talking about having the benefit of hindsight, seeing Facebook kind of, you know, blunder some of this new territory, is that on Google Plus, having the whole circles thing, you know, who's in your circles, basically, you know, how do you group your friends into these different groups? that's a feature. It's not something that you have to manage. Right. It's something that's fun to manage. It's something that's enjoyable to use. And I think that by doing that, you're, you know, making it, I guess you're giving the user more incentive, as well as more autonomy in managing their privacy. So.
I think they led the way with user interface. You know, I mean, a lot of things like kind of lead the customer where they want them to go. And for Facebook, I think it's been an issue of motivation, is they weren't motivated to lead the customer to be more private, because that naturally conflicts with their interests.
That's right. The more they share, the more people read, therefore the more they stay on there.
Right. The more things are viral, the more spread they get. Google, you know, one place I read, it said that Google Plus's greatest advantage is just that it's not Facebook. That some people are just tired of certain things.
Absolutely.
And that, like you said, it creates a competitive advantage. Now Google's trying to differentiate by making it easy, like Ben just said, to make things more private. So they've led the user with the user, you know, UI.
One of the features we didn't even cover about Google Plus, if you haven't used it, there's actually this idea of Hangout, and it's video chat amongst multiple people. And they're doing that kind of cleverly, where you actually see who of your friends are online, kind of like chat, but it's for video chat instead. Hanging out is what they call it. And we tried it beforehand. It works pretty well. It's not going to stream everybody's video at the same time at full res. It kind of switches between the person that's speaking, which is kind of clever. But I'm assuming it supports quite a few people because of the way they're doing it.
Yeah. Just to be clear, the feature basically is that I can just click a button to quote-unquote hang out, right? Like I would go to a coffee shop and hang out. That just makes me available. So anyone that I have enabled or not blocked from seeing my Hangout can see that I'm hanging out and join.
And I'm assuming when you hang out, you choose which circle you want to hang out with?
Yeah, by default, it's just everyone. Everyone can see you're hanging out, so you can hang out with whoever. But let's say I want to hang out with geeks and talk about, I don't know, something new on Google Plus. I can hang out with just my geeks circle, right? Mm-hmm. One of the other advantages of circles that we didn't mention is that no one can see what your circles are. So, you know, like Lyle, you're just in my acquaintances circle, and Miles, you're in my geek circle, or, you know, so you're not going to be offended, except that I just told you, you know.
Right, now I'm offended. And you're also lying.
I'm lying. You're right. Darn it. I'm such a bad liar.
That was a good first story. We're 24 minutes into the show. Wow. Ben, you want to tell us the next news story, sir?
Yeah. I'm sorry to say I don't have a change of topic. we were talking about Facebook and Google Plus and kind of the differences between them. Turns out that Google kind of entered this market at a good time because Facebook has just been released by the American Customer Satisfaction Index that they are ranked pretty low in the most hated, I guess. And now, to be clear, pretty high. Yeah, they're very hated. Actually, the headline says, "Is Facebook really hated more than Bank of America?" And if you define hated as having a lower customer satisfaction index, then yeah, they actually are. And what's amazing to me is, of all of the companies that are involved, you know, and they have a lot of them spanning all of these different industries, Facebook is number 10. You know, so I mean, number 10, number one being the highest, you know.
And who's number one? Who has?
Pepco.
Okay. So these are
no one likes Pepco.
Yeah. Here's the thing about this that just seems ridiculous. It's like, if you're the only one that's flying people to the moon, okay, you're the only one, and half of the people that have done that hate you, you're still the only one. Mm-hmm. You're still like, you know, how can you complain?
But then there's a huge market hole. Right.
So right. There's a market hole there. Totally. And I see that's the point. And I just think it's really funny that people are like, I'm fed up with Facebook. It's like, yeah, well, where's the other game? And now I guess there is another game.
But it's totally legitimate to say I'm fed up with Facebook. The frustration is that there's no real action item.
I think it's amazing how much
from Facebook and you're left without a social network. Yeah,
Miles, you left Facebook at one point and then you came back.
What happened?
You couldn't stay away.
Well, first off, I avoided going on Facebook in the first place for a very long time. Yeah. And then I signed up because... basically, when people say, hey, you should join Facebook, they inject your email address into the Facebook system to prompt you. So I'm like, great. Okay, they already have my contact info. They know my name and my contact info. That's
great. Didn't they make a page for you, I think I heard you say?
Yes, they did.
Who did?
a couple of friends, actually. They started constructing a page for me, a placeholder page, before I could...
So all two of your friends did that? That's amazing.
Right. And... So then I finally went, okay, I'll try this out, and over time found, like, God, this is really intrusive. From a security standpoint, I don't feel comfortable with this. That's why I cut off for a while. But then I had so many friends organizing things on Facebook, so many friends who were using Facebook. It seemed like me ducking out of it was not a solution to a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To not even participate and like help friends figure out how to deal with it or to use it as a news dissemination device right. or the like. So
you tried to get out of it, couldn't though.
I still don't use it that often. I still use it very sparingly. And I only post information now that I wouldn't mind everyone knowing, as opposed to...
So if you post anything in your Facebook account, I can mention on air. So Miles is having a sex change, everybody. It's amazing. Let's go on with something not Facebook. Jordan, do you have something that's not about Facebook or social networking in general?
I do, yes. Something about mobile phones. I think one of the most exciting things about mobile phones is all the little sensors they're packing into them these days. You know, they can just tell so much about our world. I was watching the IBM 5 and 5, 5 innovations we should have in 5 years, and one of the ones they mentioned that I wasn't thinking about at all is just the cumulative data that we can get from having all these different people wandering around with all these sensors. You know, if they were tied into networks, they said everyone could be a citizen scientist in a way just by drawing all this data. A more commercial application of it I was just reading about is some guys at Duke made an app that will tag your pictures, not just by who's in them. I mean, that's really cool that they can use facial recognition and stuff, but also the weather at the time. I mean, of course, where you were, the GPS, even the motion, they can even sense, you know, the motion from the accelerometer if you were moving when you took the picture.
So if you took a picture from a car?
Right.
A boat, a train, or dancing,
you could actually search through your pictures for pictures when you were in motion, like when you were maybe dancing or in a vehicle or something like that.
Can you jump back on the science aspect of it? What kind of things could we glean from this massive amount of data on where people are and how they move?
Yeah. It was actually more even about like sensing the environment and stuff, like when's the first frost, when is a stream run dry, like if people are just kind of out with their phones, like if you just picked up all the data from that, you know, temperature.
Okay,
you know,
so traditional sensing stuff, just a lot more locations.
Yeah.
See, I was thinking from the perspective of like traffic analysis of people, pedestrian traffic analysis, right? Like how many times do people actually go up and down an elevator? How many people repeat that process all day? And you could actually, you know, find this out from like a building maintenance, but even from a city perspective, like you really could start knowing a lot more about how people move. Now, the privacy stuff just seems to, you know, this privacy meter that happens in the back of my head all the time is kind of beeping away, goes up quite rapidly when you talk about this kind of thing. But at the same time, we live in a very data-rich environment. So it seems to make sense that you start using that data for public good, potentially. But, right. Okay, so this app that they made, the weather information and the location, this doesn't seem that important that they tag the photo with that because, of course, if you've got the time and the location, you can do a retroactive look at weather information. But I guess it's kind of cool in your archive of photos, you could say, I want all the sunny day pictures.
Right. Although, was it sunny and I was moving and it was this temperature? I mean...
Yeah, that's kind of cool. Indoors or outdoors. Yeah.
Right.
Although I kind of wonder how soon we'll have mobile phones being weather stations instead of having, you know, static weather stations. Because, I mean, there's actually a phone. I think it's a phone. It might be a tablet. But there's one phone out there now. It's an Android device that has a barometer in it.
Yeah.
I don't know how anyone's going to use a barometer, but I'm sure someone's going to come with some non-weather related.
There's a lot of cool, you know, use. With the barometers are traditionally, you know, the pressure of the environment they're in, right? Mm-hmm. So when you slam a car door, it peaks. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of data can be, you know, figured out about where you are and what's happening by the barometer.
But barometers which one detects humidity? Isn't that a barometer?
No, it's a humidity sensor, isn't it? Oh, let's do a search real quick.
Almost said humidifier. But
I know it.
But it's, yeah.
Will you search that while I'm mentioning?
Sure, I'll search something for you.
KOSP co-sponsors the 2011 Carmel Bach Festival, a 15-day celebration celebrating of music and ideas with films and lectures, chamber concerts, and full orchestral performances, July 16th through the 30th. Tickets and information, 624-1521 or bachfestival.org. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. More information at cruzeio.com. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, I've got Jordan Hart. He's a technical director of the Digital Media Academy. Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy. And Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie. And a guy that's wearing shoes that are just way too small for his feet. We are not taking questions and comments today from the phones because Rick is off gallivanting around the known universe. We are, though, answering questions through email if you'd like to give us a shout-out. I'll also get my chat on. If you want to get into chatting, you can do that by going to geekspeak.org. One of the show pages on the left-hand side, Geek Chat. What else can I mention? We don't have a Geek Bit today.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah?
I got a Geek Bit.
No, you don't. Go ahead. Go ahead.
My Geek Bit is that I'm totally wrong. You are right.
Go ahead.
That a barometer measures air pressure, and a hygrometer measures water, right? Exactly.
Now, I think the confusion is that most of the time, so humidity density changes air density, if you will, right? So the
humidity and the air relationship.
Very related. And lots of times one of them will have both sensors, right? So you'll actually have a combined sensor package.
Yeah. And actually, I do actually have a Geek Bit relating to those sensors. The first hygrometer was made by Leonardo da Vinci. I learned this at the Leonardo da Vinci Museum.
How do you do that?
In Europe.
How was his work?
It's really cool. Basically, you take a scale. You know, you put one thing on one side, one thing on the other, and you weigh which one is heavier.
Oh, you just put air in one.
But no. Yeah, exactly. You just put air in one of them. No, he had a piece of wax in one of them and a cotton ball in the other one. And when it got more humid, the wax was unaffected and the cotton ball absorbed the humidity and became heavier.
Interesting.
Therefore,
was that
it
a really big cotton ball?
I don't think so. Mm. I don't think it was a huge cotton ball. It was probably a really precise scale. You just couldn't measure that on a windy day.
Right.
The entire thing. Yeah, anyway, pretty cool. And
you know, it's a whenever we cover science stories and the geeks mess up like that, I mean, we didn't exactly mess up. We kind of knew the way to research it. Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised that we mess up, right? We're always talking about bad science education. And it's true that I wasn't 100% sure that the barometer measured air pressure. And we should be sure of that in our world. We should understand these basic ideas.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a great thing about the internet at your fingertips, though.
It's true. You know,
you don't need to. Hey, look it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Immediate feedback.
You know what? It took like 4 seconds for you to find out what it was, how to make one, who made the first one, or who made the first barometer. You can check that out, too.
Yes, but why do you have bad weather at a low pressure and good weather at a high pressure?
Because the low pressure sucks all the good bad weather.
Oh, do tell. Do tell, Mom. It's a little bit of weather information today. Facebook and weather, that's the name of the show.
Well, if you have, first of all, warm air can hold water much better than cold air can. And if the air is rising, you actually end up with a low pressure zone. And with that air is rising, it's also cooling at the same time. It's expanding and cooling.
Mm-hmm.
And as it expands and cools, you get condensation into clouds and you get rainfall. And so it's when you have that updraft, that's
going to happen.
Yeah, that's where that low pressure zone is coming from. On the other hand, if you're in a large desert, if you're in Arizona or the Sahara or the like, that's a high pressure zone where the air is coming down from the stratosphere down to sea level. And you have basically this cold air, which doesn't have any moisture, then going down and having the pressure increase, but it's not carrying any water with it.
Right.
And so you end up with a very arid zone.
Awesome. Thank you so much for that. See, and if we all had barometers on us all the time, we could be finding out what the air pressure was at every moment, everywhere. We'd have a lot of data potentially for better analysis of weather conditions, though it gets chaotic quickly. I had something I wanted to cover. I can't recall what it was. Oh, yeah, I want to invite listener participation. You can't call in today, but we need somebody for GeekSpeak. So if you're in the local area or feel like you could plan events in the local area and you want to make GeekSpeak more successful and support us, please do drop us an email. We would like an event planner to organize live shows for GeekSpeak and GeekSpeak audiences. We have a lot of desire to do some live content with a projector behind us so we can talk about things like resolution, and I mean computer resolution, not like resolving issues, things we can't cover on the radio. And we'd love to have some audience live shows. We seem to have a lot of interest in that. So if you're an event planner or interested in doing that, please drop us a note at geekspeak.org. And of course, all the stuff we talk about today on GeekSpeak right after the show, we make sure is up online with more details, information, so you can find out how wrong we actually were. All the information is at geekspeak.org.
You know, if you're any more deprecating, you'll sound like the car guys.
Yeah, I know. That's where I get it from, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
My laugh might not be as annoying, though. I'm not sure.
No, I don't think so.
No, I love it.
As heard on KUSP, immediately following GeekSpeak.
Immediately following us.
Saturdays.
Let's move on to the next Geek Bit. The next news story. I think Jordan's up, or is it? I have a geek bit.
I just did a geek bit, and it's technically your turn.
Let's do a thumb war here.
I have a really short but really relevant story to what we were talking about.
All right, Miles. No, go ahead, Ben.
massive amounts of data. Yeah. Digital Universe, the IDC Digital Universe study projected that there will be 1.8 zettabytes in 2011.
I don't know how much that is.
It's a lot.
Okay.
That's all you need to know.
Well, let's count through the units.
Okay,
right?
One,
two,
three, four.
Byte, kilobyte, megabyte. Each of these you're making a
thousand fold.
Yeah, so you're multiplying by a thousand. Three orders of magnitude.
So megabyte, gigabyte, terabyte.
Petabyte.
Exabyte.
Zettabyte.
That's really big.
It's tremendous.
Can one of you do it? I was just watching you guys both do that at the same time, so I didn't pay attention to the actual numbers. Would you guys figure out, can we do an analogy on size? So if you've got a normal Word document, how big is that, Miles? A normal email.
Here's the problem with that.
50 kilobytes.
We're going to get a resulting number that we can't understand. Like, we can't understand 1.8 zettabytes. We're not going to be able to understand that we can put however many quadrillion
This is like talking about how big the biggest star is. Like, it's just so large, you can't figure out.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't you know those visual diagram things? They talk about, like, if this is an email message and you print it on a piece of paper and that's 50 kilobytes, and then you stack your paper up to the moon, that's a gigabyte. And then you take that whole thing and condense it down to a P and you stack that to the moon. That kind of thing is what you have to do, right?
It's just
completely insane. It doesn't help you. Okay.
Well, here's kind of a metaphor. 1.8 billion terabytes. So one of the really big hard drives that you'll go out and buy nowadays, right? A 2 terabyte hard drive. We're talking about like
everyone who's on the internet today. Give them a 2 terabyte drive.
Okay.
That is how much data we're talking about.
There you go. And that's how much, that's not how much data we have, period. That's how much data will be generated this year.
Oh.
In this 12 months. And then
it's a lot of data.
It's just ridiculous.
All right.
That's how much will be created and stored. Not just created.
We still need a title for the show. So, ridiculous amounts of data, Facebook, and barometers. Those are the words we're using right now. Miles, your news story, sir.
And now for something completely different.
Thank God.
MySpace.
Taxes.
Oh, God. Don't go there.
Amazon has been... it's been very common for people to buy stuff on Amazon and not pay any sales tax.
Right.
Even if you are... For example, in the state of California, and you're buying from one of their affiliate vendors who is in the state of California, and you should be paying sales tax. You should be reporting it, and almost never.
Yeah,
no,
that's people who are selling things through Amazon, right?
Right.
Like operating a shop out of their house through Amazon.
The general rule is if the seller is not in a taxable state, they can sell to the buyer, and the buyer is actually responsible to pay the sales tax on that in their end of the year taxes, and no one actually does that.
Right.
So, or very few people do that unless they're really paying close attention to tax law. So you could buy...
Or someone is paying very close attention to them.
So you could be buying actually through some company in California, living in California. The sale goes through Amazon and technically no taxes are paid to California for sales tax. It's a big loophole.
Right. It's a loophole that is looking to be changed. It's one thing that's being pushed by the governor and by the state legislature to try to get this tax revenue that they see as losing.
Mm-hmm.
And Amazon is, countering with the fact that if California passes this law, they're going to shut down all their California affiliates.
They already did. I got a notification.
Oh, they already did.
They
okay.
Did.
Mm-hmm.
So you might not know this, but the geeks in the room are not exactly savvy business people. And you know this because Miles and I have been doing the show for about 11 years. And how much money have you made on GeekSpeak?
Negative. Wait, make money.
We lose money all the time.
This costs me.
Yeah, it costs us lots of money to do the Geek Speak show. It's a little bit of fame, though. That's kind of cool.
We walk down the street, and people hear his hear Lyle's voice and say, "Wait, are you Lyle Troxell? Look, I listen to Geek Speak." Never happened to me.
That happened to me.
And you're like, who? Yeah.
But anyway,
oh, that's nice.
Anyway, we don't make any money on this show at all. So recently I was like, I did a book interview a while ago. We're going to do another book interview. We really should go ahead and link the books on the GeekSpeak site through Amazon and actually maybe get some money back so we can buy more t-shirts and give them away. I've never actually, like, this is the bad business mind of me. I'm like, I'm not going to get money out of this. I'm going to make it harder for me. But so I finally, I mean, like less than a month ago, I signed up for an affiliate program through Amazon. And the last time we did a book, I linked it that way. No sales, by the way. Because we know people listen to us on air, they don't go to our website. But anyways, and then, like last week, I get this notification. Yeah, we're firing. We're getting rid of all the affiliates.
We're firing you.
Yeah, that's the phrasing that some people are using.
And they've done this in other states as well, in New York, Illinois, Rhode Island, and North Carolina.
But to counter that, I was going, to counter that, yesterday, last night, I get an email from Bookshop Santa Cruz. And Bookshop Santa Cruz is our local bookshop. They do great. It's a great store. I love that store. And I've been going there for years. And every once in a while, you know, KOSP does interviews at that location and things of that nature. In any case, they're saying, you know, you might have the great news about the new Brown legislation that basically says we're not going to allow, we've got, if you're going to sell stuff in California, you've got to tax and you've got to give us the revenue from it. Doesn't matter where you're located. It's basically, this is the issue, right? The thing that's nice about that is that Bookshop Santa Cruz is a Santa Cruz company and has an online store, can't compete with Amazon, partially because they have to charge tax. And so,
because their business is incorporated here, physically located.
And then our large California. Enough corporation to have a separate corporation outside of California do this weird thing that Amazon does. So for them, this is a giant boon to them. All of a sudden, they can get closer to competing at Amazon's level. And so it's a great thing for them. And the other counter that they did is, by the way, we're going to figure out how to do an affiliate program. So you can get a little bit of kickback from, you know, stuff that you sell. If you give a recommendation of someone going to our store to buy something, you get a small percentage of that sale, which Amazon was doing.
Which is an interesting part of the conversation, because those states where they've passed similar legislation and Amazon has killed the affiliate program, they have seen a drop in their tax revenue. But I do wonder...
Why?
Because the amount of money, the income tax and stuff like that that affiliates were making, that money lost has not been recouped.
Okay, I see.
The income tax?
Interesting. So there's still some times when income tax happens. I think we're missing a point. Was it such that an affiliate program that was selling through Amazon, if they were local, was doing tax?
The tax revenue that the states were trying to get through that affiliate program didn't come to pass because the affiliates were dropped. And then because those affiliates were making less money, you had less money ended up going to the coffers of those state governments.
Gotcha.
So...
Oh, I see. Not from income tax, but from business taxes.
Sorry, business tax, yeah.
I see. Well, that's dangerous. I see the point. What you're saying is a California business, for example, who has been selling a giant volume through Amazon. So no sales tax was going to California for those things, but that business was getting a lot of revenue, and therefore that business's traditional tax, non-sales tax, was high. And when Amazon dropped them, all those sales disappeared, and we had a net California loss, though it wasn't California, it was a different state. But
right.
Okay, gotcha. So I get that. I totally get that. But it does make sense for state of California to get sales tax on things. But I guess that's the conflict right there.
That's the conflict. And there's also that conflict, which is what you brought up with the independent bookstores that are a dying breed, and that they are a great resource, unfortunately, that is going away, is dwindling, mostly because of the competition from Amazon. Is it worth it to have a slightly lower tax revenue, but you're diversifying the field again? So for a long term, would there be a long term benefit?
Right.
That's an open question. I'm not trying to say it's going to be one way or another. I don't know, but.
Interesting. Thanks. Cool story. All right, back on Facebook. No, I'm just kidding. Jordan, you had another story, sir?
Yeah. So recently, you know, Matt came out with the Thunderbolt port. I'm sure you guys have talked about that. Really high speeds, 10 gigabits, you know, I think it is.
And just to be clear, it's kind of like USB and FireWire. And now there's this new thing called Thunderbolt. It also actually does display, integrated display. So the port on the new MacBook Pros, for example, has a Thunderbolt port that's your video and your high-speed connection port.
One port to rule them all.
Yep, and you can even daisy chain with it, I believe. So eventually you'll be able to run a hard drive and a monitor at the same time.
And the design of the port can actually support optic cables, though the optical interface actually has to be in the head of the cable. But go on. Which means you can do extremely long runs of cable.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So one question I had with those is, you know, where are the hard drives to support that sort of, you know, throughput? Like there's
the
still...
Apple Store.
Not actually, no.
Really? Well,
they didn't have them, no.
Well, right. Yeah.
When I went a couple months ago.
Yeah, they have them now. But...
Yeah, they haven't. I mean, they're not quite selling the drives yet. It's on the verge. But even so, you know, the hard drive is just going to be limited by the speed of the hard drive itself.
Yes.
You know, and I think a lot of people have been looking for that bottleneck to be alleviated. You know, faster drives. We're doing solid state hybrid drives. Ben, I think you have a hybrid drive.
Yeah, I have a hybrid.
All three of us.
No, I have a hybrid drive and a solid state.
Oh, okay. Wow.
I took out my CD drive. Oh, my God. My computer boots in
Do you boot off the solid state one?
Yes. Yeah. It boots in like 12 seconds, including my sign and everything.
But you shut
down. Well, aren't you just a fancy pants?
I am a fancy pants. Thank you very much.
Is that
that's the show title, Fancy Pants.
Is that NAND flash? Is that?
So what we're talking about here is hard drives store a lot of data, and when you connect a hard drive through like a USB cable or a FireWire cable or these new cables, you are potentially limited by the cable connection speed to get your data on and off. And actually, that hasn't been a bottleneck for a long time. The FireWire 800, for example, can go faster than a spindle type hard drive. But now you can raid NAND drives, right? You could stripe them and get really fast speeds out of a block of hard drives. And so maybe you could saturate the Thunderbolt
or daisy chain them and read off of four drives simultaneously.
So IBM has just announced that they have a new technology coming out, PCM. Hold on one second.
No, PCMCIA is a really old technology.
Phase change memory. Here we go. So it's produced phase change memory chips. And so apparently it's got, you know, it's much faster. Unlike the NAND flash, you don't have to actually wipe everything before writing to it again, which should speed it up and also let it go through a lot more cycles. A lot of this flash stuff, the consumer stuff, you can only write to like 3,000 times. The enterprise stuff, you know, more like 5 to 10,000, which is pretty good. But this stuff will go up to like 100,000. So it's, you know, it's fast like flash, but more reusable like the disks.
Are they actually releasing some drives of this sort?
So there's going to be a limited release over the next 5 years. And by 2016, we'll be seeing them, you know, in
future
wide.
Future tech. You can't buy one right now. All right.
Right. No, you can't buy one. It's coming out. But that's been a bottleneck I've been, you know, waiting for. I see. Okay. So if we get, you know, if we get gigabit internet, if we start getting gigabit internet, you know, over the next couple of years and we get these Thunderbolt cables and we have, you know, flash this, I'd like to see something much more robust, you know, bigger flash drives. It should be able to, hold a lot more space. Each cell is not just going to be like on or off. There's actually going to be four states of it, you know. So, you know, again, just be able to compress a lot more data into a small space.
And they just had to call it PCM.
Yeah.
I mean, there's already pulse code modulation.
What does PCM say? Phase?
Hold on.
Phase something something. You know, I've been waiting for this actually for like 15 years. I saw it on Star Trek The Next Generation. I've been waiting for it.
Phase change memory, by the way.
Oh, good. Speaking of speeds, you know, you can do the speed tests for your DSL connection, your network connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing some speed tests at home and getting, you know, the 3 megabits per second speed. And I went to UCSC and decided to run it because the browser was still open.
Oh, no.
317 megabits per second downstream. from San Francisco. And of course, yeah, hard drives. And I don't think hard drives can do that.
How many? Right?
Well, they were just randomly.
The new SATA 3 SSDs can do that.
Can do that.
What time of day was it, too? Because it
doesn't matter. I don't know. But the upstream was 114 megabits.
Wow.
It's like, this is why I like being at the office.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, if you were there on like a Sunday at 2 a.m. or something, you'd probably get even faster. You know,
sounds
it probably
like
depends on how many people on campus are using it. You know?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that might be the limit of the process that's generating the numbers.
Oh, God.
I mean, that's pretty fast.
That's really fast.
Yeah. Your tax dollars hard at work.
It took 10 seconds. Mr. Jaffe, your story, sir.
Okay, there once was a company called Nortel, and that company, after the bubble...
I thought it was going to rhyme. Can you make it rhyme? There once was a company
from Nortel. That crossed my mind, and I was thinking, I should think of a rhyme to that. And then
let's avoid the limericks.
I should avoid it. Yeah, it's just going to be bad.
If you'd like to make a limerick for what Ben just started...
This is the listener limerick challenge.
We will
not read it on air, but you know,
yeah, we won't
read it on air. So make it decent.
I don't know. Limericks are pretty geeky.
There once was a company named Nortec. Go on.
Oh God.
No, don't. We're not.
I want you to
just do the story.
Okay, so Nortel had tons and tons of patents, over 6,000 patents, and these all had to do with technology related things. And so recently, Google made a bid on the patent portfolio of this company back in April, at the beginning of April. And the assumption was that Google would, you know, push for it and get it. But it turns out that after this whole bidding thing, it turns out that a consortium bought it for bought all of them for $4.5 billion. And the consortium has Apple, Microsoft, RIM, RIM, Sony, and some other companies. So basically everyone in the tech space except for Google. And this is going to be interesting to see because Google's probably going to start getting lawsuits from these companies that now own these patents for infringement on things like Android, their Android products and stuff.
The way patent stuff works in large corporation space is that you trade it. You use it as muscle for negotiation. You never really go into lawsuits because the people that make money on the lawsuits are the lawyers. This is much more of a way to force companies to do what you want kind of negotiation tactics. The thing that's really depressing about this is that in the free software space or the small people deciding to do something cool space, if you conflict with one of these patents, you have nothing to trade. So you basically, it stops you from making any money.
Yeah, pretty much. The thing that I find especially geeky about this and not just a normal business story is that Google actually made some interesting bids. Instead of bidding, let's say, $1.9 billion, they bid $1,902,160,540. And if there are any mathematicians, they'll recognize that as Brun's constant, which is a mathematical constant. Then they bid 2.6 blah, 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 blah billion. And then when it got to 3 billion, they bid pi.
Yeah,
they bid pi billion dollars. So 3.14159 billion. And I thought that was fantastic. I also really enjoy this quote from the article. It says either they were supremely confident or they were bored. It's a bunch of geeks working at Google. Deciding to bid mathematical constants.
Is this an advertisement for Google? Is anybody getting some payola from Google?
Yeah, that's me. I'm sorry.
But the same time, they are getting some press from this.
Yeah.
I mean,
They
didn't win, if they won the bid, then they get even more notoriety about it, like get more information about it. It becomes geeky. They become cooler. If they don't win the bid, they save that money, and they still get the press for it. So
Yeah, exactly. I don't think it was just the two choices, supremely confident or bored. I think it was definitely a PR thing, you know, because Google everyone sees Google do this all the time. It's just a bunch of geeks making funny in-jokes, and it gives them tech cred, definitely.
Yeah, I think a lot of times they do things just because it's fun, you know. I mean, with this secondary motivation, you know, they know that there's long-term benefit. But, you know, if you like the different, you know, Google homepage, you know, Google.com, they throw different things in there. You know, they clearly just like to mess around and get people talking about it. That's always an auxiliary benefit.
That's
just kind of, you know, having fun with stuff.
Miles, new story, sir? Probably your last for today.
My last for today.
We'll
have to choose very, very carefully. I'll do something fairly geeky. The Future of Time is the name of this paper that I'm looking at right now.
Recursion. Ow. Go on.
It's talking about universal coordinated time, or time coordinated and the leap second.
UTC, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things that people are talking about more and more is let's not tie time directly to the rotation of the Earth.
Okay. I have no problem with that.
Because we have to keep adding those leap seconds to try to figure
out.
Because
seconds of that nature.
We have atomic clocks. We have clocks that are more accurate than the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
The Earth wobbles a little bit, or we have clocks that are so accurate that we can tell that the Earth gained a few microseconds or gained a little less than a microsecond because of the Japanese earthquake.
Yes,
you know that. The reason we know that is because we have clocks that are more accurate than the Earth is.
Right.
And there's a question of how do you bring about this change? How do you break away from it being based upon...
See, the thing that's nice about the Earth rotation being our point of reference is that everyone can kind of agree that it's a good reference point. Instead, if it's some clock somewhere in a cave, it just seems a little...
I mean, you can say at the equator, the sun... consistently rises at this time, consistently sets at this time, and you can predict all of those things. And if you start getting off by 1 second here, 1 second there, eventually, you know, you're off by half a day.
Okay, but that's the thing.
And then midnight
eventually
is
like 10,000 years.
Oh, sure.
And if you live through it...
On the contrary, it is not about 10,000 years. A human being would notice that time frame if they were able to live 10,000 years. But when you're talking about satellites in orbit... The drift that comes from for example, relativistic motions, even though they're not going so, they're not going towards the speed of light, but they're going fast enough that their clocks are moving slightly slower than the ones on Earth, and you have to find that differential
and then you gotta
account for it.
Right.
And you need to have very accurate clocks to be able to track these things, be able to track all these differences between them.
So the and resetting the clocks and always resetting them to something that is based around the Earth seems a little strange. So the point, I guess, is if you do stationary, you know, just make it like whatever this atomic clock is, that is the time. Over time, midnight will be, you know, 12 o'clock at night will be bright. The sun will be out. Like over time, we will shift away from what the rotation of the Earth is doing. But the timeline is so long that it won't matter.
But no, but that's the whole point of us having noon and midnight and all of that is that it's based around the sun.
Well, so, but what I'm saying is at some point in the future, the term noon or midnight might not be.
That's far less likely than putting up just a set of units and just saying that a day currently is, you know, this many units and you don't base it upon human perceptions of a time unit, like a second.
Right.
Hmm.
Interesting.
I don't know if I buy that. I'm going to read the article, though.
Yeah, but wouldn't 5 o'clock just eventually come to mean a different time of day?
Yes.
Let's say 5 o'clock p.m.?
That's right.
I mean, over enough time?
We would just and be like, bedtime would be 5 o'clock.
But that removes all of our assumptions of how time, our measurement of time correlates to the day.
Right. You wouldn't say noon is the time of day when the sun's above you.
But I don't believe that human beings are ever going to give up 11 o'clock in the morning is before the sun hits its apex.
I don't
in the
know
sky.
Why they wouldn't. Why would you not if the time shifted such that it would just change? I mean,
for human beings, it doesn't matter. For machines, it matters.
That's right.
And this, I think, is where you're going to start seeing a schism between where you're actually dealing with physics, when you're actually dealing with the how machines have to deal with the world versus how human beings have to deal with the
world. But I think it's presumptuous to assume what people will be like 5,000 years from now. I don't think that's a relevant conversation. So set it up and see what happens. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by the 2011 Carmel Bach Festival, a 15-day celebration of music and ideas with films and lectures, chamber concerts, and full orchestral performances. July 16th through the 30th. Tickets information at 624-1521 or BachFestival.org. Geekspeak on KOSP is supported by Pacific Sun Properties, an independent and locally owned real estate company. Pacific Sun Properties, an experienced team for buying and selling, managing and renting property in Santa Cruz County. On the web at PacificSunProperties.com. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. Coming up next is The Car Guys. Car Talk on QSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. Miles, Ben, thank you very much for being here as always, and Jordan, thanks for joining us on Geekspeak. We'll see you next week. I'm Lyle Troxell.